Hi, and welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist, and I'm here to help you and your family reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror. Today, we're going to be talking about why this phrase that you've heard a million times, if you see something, say something, is more than just a slogan. In fact, it's something that can save your life as well as thousands of people around you. You know, a lot of people think that if they don't say anything, they're going to be a so-called innocent bystander. But you're not innocent if you stand by and do nothing. Look at the people in San Bernardino who apparently knew a lot about the terrorists in San Bernardino, who were, in fact, plotting for quite some time to carry out with their threats, well, to carry out with what they were plotting, which was the San Bernardino, California attack. Now, for months, they were planning this attack, and they were gathering, planning an attack at least, and they were gathering a lot of things that they needed to carry out the attack. So there have been reports that their neighbors, particularly a California woman, that has, you know, I think she's been keeping her name out of the press, but it's been reported that she has noted suspicious, quote unquote, suspicious activity at the house in the neighborhood where the couple, the terrorist couple, Syed Farouk and his wife, Malik, Tashfeen Malik, were planning the attack. They were living with their mother and a baby. And there were many packages, quite a few packages is the quote, being delivered within a short amount of time to this home. And there were other neighbors as well who realized that there was suspicious activity going on in the garage. I mean, there were quite a few people who were involved in this and kept doing a lot of work out in the garage after these packages were delivered. You know, when after the attack, ammunition was found, 4,500 rounds of ammunition, 12 pipe bomb type devices, bomb making tools, and so on inside their apartment and garage. And obviously all of this material got there somehow, and there were people who knew about it who said nothing. Then we have the attack in Belgium, in Molenbeek, I mean, where the terrorists came from the neighborhood of Molenbeek, where in fact there are a lot of people who have been going to the Middle East, traveling to the Middle East to learn how to come back and attack. Nobody in Molenbeek, well, I shouldn't say nobody, actually, there after the fact, there have been some reports that people, for example, there was a mother who said that she tried to tell the police that her son had traveled abroad to the Middle East and that she believed he was going there to take part in terrorist camps, and the police did nothing. And then there were families in the neighborhood. In fact, when the police came to arrest some of the terrorists before the major attack in Belgium, these people threw bottles at the police who were making the arrest. So not only did they not report, but they tried to sabotage and express their anger at the fact that the authorities were arresting the terrorists. So, you know, this whole idea of needing to say something if you see something literally means the difference between saving and losing tens, hundreds, thousands of lives. So why does this happen? You know, obviously in terms of neighbors or other people who know what the terrorists are plotting and they don't say anything, some of these people are friends of the terrorists. Some of them share their fanatical beliefs. of the terrorists' extremist beliefs, and that's why they're purposely not saying anything. But there are a lot of people who aren't friends, who don't share these beliefs, who are just normal, everyday citizens, and who are afraid to say something for many different reasons. There's a name for this that was developed ever since the most famous account of bystanders seeing something or hearing something and not doing something about it. It started in 1964, the famous Kitty Genovese attack. Kitty Genovese was a woman who was killed at age 28. She was murdered by stabbing outside an apartment building in Queens, New York. And this was in March 1964. There were 37 or 38 witnesses who saw or heard the attack and who didn't call the police. Now, this has been called the bystander effect, who's planning on doing something imminently or sometime in the future, or if they're going to be accused of Islamophobia. That actually is the flip side of this is, do I report or do I then become accused of Islamophobia? So there was a recent example. I love to bring up headlines because they allow me to elucidate different aspects of coping with terrorism, of the state of terrorism, helping you to, in this case, figure out whether you should report or not. And again, the answer is to err on the side of reporting. Now, there was a recent case of a woman who was on a plane and who saw a man sitting next to her. She tried to actually talk with him. She saw a man writing as they were taxiing, and she started to try to begin a conversation with her seatmate. And he wasn't really very friendly. And she then saw that he was noting on a pad these strange symbols. And she thought that maybe they were, it was a different language, or it was a code, or it was something that had to do with this man plotting to take down the plane. So, She kind of tried an interesting technique. She passed a note to the flight attendant saying that she was sick. Like, she didn't want to, call over the flight attendant and say out loud, "I think this man sitting next to me is a terrorist." So she first started by writing a note saying that she was sick. And this got their attention. And she eventually got to talk to the flight attendants more privately, and she told him that she was concerned about her seatmate. Now, what happened was, it turned out that her seatmate was an Italian Ivy League professor, and it was a math equation. He was scribbling these math equations because he was on his way to give a talk in Canada. This was on a flight from Philadelphia to Syracuse, and his name was Guido Menzio, a well-known economics professor at the University of Pennsylvania. So he was called off the plane. He states that he was always treated respectfully, and he was called off the plane, and he was questioned. Now, to be fair, it wasn't just that he was scribbling these strange notations. He also had olive skin. He was Italian, and he had a dark, scruffy beard and scruffy hair and a mustache. And so she obviously mistook him for being of Middle Eastern descent. And this, fed into why she was concerned about this seatmate. So what happened was, he was eventually allowed back on the plane. She didn't go back on the plane. She took a later flight. And the plane was delayed for 2 hours. And She was apparently criticized by some for having overreacted. Well, you know, if it had turned out that this man was indeed a terrorist, and it was her quick thinking that saved the plane and the passengers and herself, people wouldn't be that quick to say, oh, she overreacted, or it was Islamophobia. So I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, you don't want to be accused of Islamophobia or racial profiling. You don't want to you know, jump the gun and alert authorities to something that may turn out to be completely innocent. Well, I'll have to confess that I have felt, there have been times, particularly at an airport, I travel a lot, so, you know, I've had numerous occasions at an airport to see people waiting for the plane or on the plane waiting for it to take off, where there is something suspicious about them, perhaps because of their Middle Eastern dress and their talking in ways that to their friends who seem either to be suspiciously quiet or suspiciously animated. It could be either, really. I mean, if it were a real terrorist. And I've had to ask myself, should I report this? Should I? There have been times when I've thought of asking to go on a different plane, actually. But I have to confess, no, I have never reported it that I can recall. Let's put it that way. And no, none of my planes have fallen out of the sky. But, you know, as time goes on, with each day, we get, the situation gets to be more and more dangerous. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to realize that the terrorist attacks are becoming more frequent and more in countries where they weren't before, in places where they weren't before. And so we do need to take this advice to, if you see something, say something, much more carefully. Again, as each day is going by, we need to really think about that. And again, try to remember that not all Muslims are terrorists and not all terrorists are Muslims. However, even domestic terrorists have been converted. They are, the whole point is that they are radical extremists. They have been converted to this ideology. And we do need to, it's very delicate to make the distinction between between something that is representative of your fear, perhaps your paranoia, representative of Islamophobia, versus something which is more representative of something that you really should be afraid of. Now, I'll give you an example of another extreme. There's a recent, just recently, there was an example of Islamophobia in California. A student at a California high school named Bayan Zelif was a 17-year-old girl, a senior, was mislabeled in her high school yearbook as and given the name of Isis Phillips. Now, there was actually, unfortunately, an unfortunate name in these times, but there was a girl named Isis Phillips who went to that school. She had transferred out, however, by the end of senior year, and she was misidentified in the yearbook as well as a different name. And so the Bayan, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, she is, you know, has expressed her consternation, her anger. Clearly she's going to be filing a lawsuit. What she said was, she's extremely saddened, disgusted, hurt, and embarrassed by this mislabeling in the yearbook. And, oh, and I should say that she wore traditional Muslim dress. Now, there is an investigation going on, and there was a student from the yearbook committee who has said that the crisis, the identity crisis, this mislabeling was an honest mistake. And he said, quote, "We have a campus of 3,200 students. There are going to be imperfections." Now, you know, that does seem a little weak, quite frankly, a little weak of an excuse. But as of yet, we don't really know the exact details, the exact origin of this mistake. But we do know what is really unfortunate is that since this came out, and since there have been students who have been supportive of her and made signs supportive of her, and there are other students who have torn the signs down. And regardless of the error in the yearbook and whether it was a mistake or not, there actually have been students expressing their displeasure at their anger, actually, at her, you know, making, as they would say, a big deal out of this. So what does this mean? Psychologically, what it means is that students, just like not just students, many people are in fact frightened when they see someone wearing traditional Muslim garb, because it's, in a way, you know, you could look at it as a trigger to PTSD, or to the, you know, what we're feeling, as something that reminds us of 9/11. And sure, it is not fair to take it out on a 17-year-old senior in high school who is about to be graduated. In fact, she's afraid to walk down the aisle. She's afraid that when her name is going to be called out, that her real name, that there will be others in the audience who will yell out ISIS. And indeed, there might. She's having relatives come from Jordan, and she's, you know, very upset about all of this. And so out of fear, what I think happened is that I think it was purposeful and, you know, a practical joke, whatever you want, you may want to call it that. But really, it's because of this fear that she has generated, and the way that the students express their anger at becoming fearful, you know, of her making them feel fear, is by this trick or this mistake or this, you know, purposely mislabeling her. And that's really unfortunate. So this is an example of the kinds of things that do happen, and that Islamophobia is real. And we are, as terrorist attacks increase, as I was saying, Islamophobia increases. So you need to ask yourself before you report something, are you really scared? Are there rational signs that there are, you know, that there is an imminent terrorist attack, or that there is a plot for a terrorist attack, or there is something dangerous happening, or is this just your paranoia and your Islamophobia speaking? And also, do you want to be in the news either for having saved people, or the opposite? Are you afraid of being criticized for overreacting? Now, it's really hard to give you absolute rules of when to report something. If you see something, say something. I do say that you should err on the side of caution. And if you do see things that make you feel that something suspicious is going on, you should certainly think about reporting it. The only thing you need to do to be extra careful is to ask yourself, is this really something that is rationally suspicious, or could it be that my paranoia or my Islamophobia is making me overreact? Now, there isn't any, you know, there aren't any hard and fast rules about that, except that the Department of Homeland Security talks about 8 signs of terrorism. Now, these are more things like terrorist plots, not like seeing somebody drop a bag off at the airport and leave it alone and disappear. But let me tell you this, surveillance, people taking pictures and making drawings, particularly of landmarks, like if you're at the Statue of Liberty or something else that would be a dramatic landmark for the terrorists to attack. They are information gathering, asking people where you work or at the airport or places for information. If you think that people are going into restricted areas, for example, these are tests of security. If there are suspicious transactions, so this would be related to funding. If you think that there are people who are trying in some way to collect funds for terrorists, then of course acquiring supplies. If you see people buying things that are bomb making supplies, for example, suspicious persons out of place. They can be in places they're not supposed to be, or they look like they're not supposed to be. They don't fit into the scene. If you think that people might be making a dry or trial run. And then, obviously, if people are what they say call deploying assets, if they look like they're getting in position to create a terrorist attack. Now, the campaign, to see something, say something, actually started in the New York City subways, and it has then been adopted by Homeland Security in 2010 to make it be a national campaign. And more recently, there has been developed an app. Instead of see something, say something, it's see something, send something. And you can send words or a photograph of what it is that you're suspicious of. This is an app to connect concerned citizens, first responders, and law enforcement directly to key intelligence centers throughout the United States. Now, what you are supposed to be looking out for, they give examples as well. I mean, it's all the similar kinds of things that you probably have heard of, but, another part that gets into this is denial. Even if you do see something that seems very suspicious, part of us doesn't want to believe that that's what it is. So that's another aspect that you have to keep in mind. But if you seem suspicious or out of place, vehicles, individuals, mail, packages, luggage abandoned in a crowded place, such as an airport or shopping mall. If you see individuals recording, watching, or photographing, or monitoring activities, especially, as I was saying before, near places that would be typical terrorist on the wish list of places the terrorists would like to attack. You know, these are all the kinds of things that you should be aware of and that you should report. And again, either, of course, if it's something that's an emergency, if it's something really imminent, you don't just use the app or don't just walk over to somebody if that's going to take a while. Call 911. This is not meant to replace 911, which is for emergencies. The bottom line is that you need to just give it the test of whether it is so hard because nobody wants to do racial profiling. If you look at who has committed the terrorist attacks in the past, you get an idea of who is likely to commit them in the future. So again, if you see something, say something. If you see something, send something. And I will be back with my next podcast. I love to take headlines in the news and use them as illustrations of things that you need to understand about terrorism in general, like the stories that I told you about today. Basically, I am trying to help you confront the monster under the bed each time in a different way. I put it on my couch. The monster is terrorism. I turn on the lights and I try to make it less scary. Also, keep a lookout for my book that's going to be soon to be released. lions and tigers and terrorists, oh my, how to protect your child in a time of terror. Again, it's not just a catchy slogan. If you see something, say something, or send something. I'm Dr. Carol, the Terrorist Therapist.